Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk, and I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
Today we have someone with us who, while it's a bit of a treat for me, her life has been anything but. Today's guest, former Sergeant Kayla Williams, was a member of the military. The treat for me is having someone to have a real conversation with about what really happened to her in her life during military service. You know, so many times nowadays, for all kinds of reasons, folks who are in the military or just coming out of the military really concerned about saying what was true for them and their experiences. But I guarantee you today's conversation is with someone who is very much dedicated to telling the truth of what her life was like while in the military. Kayla Williams, you are the author of Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, I got some questions to ask you, obviously. You are a former Arabic linguist with the United States Army, 101st Airborne in Iraq. Is that your native language? How did you get to be a linguist, an Arabic linguist?
I was assigned Arabic by random chance, needs of the Army, computer-generated number, that I ended up in Arabic as opposed to Korean or, say, Chinese. I enlisted in the Army back in 2000 and chose to be a linguist. I thought it was exciting that they would pay me to learn a foreign language instead of me having to pay someone to teach me.
Okay.
But then it was just chance that I ended up in Arabic.
All right. Let's go back a bit. Tell me where you were born and how you grew up.
I was born in Columbus, Ohio,
okay. And
grew up there. My parents split up when I was pretty young, just a couple of years old, and I was primarily raised by my mother, a single mom and artist, but I did still see my dad quite a bit. And then I went to college, got my undergrad degree, and got a job. I was I moved down to Tampa, Florida, and was living there, bought a house, bought a car, had a steady boyfriend. I did all the stuff you're supposed to do in your early 20s, right?
Okay.
But I felt like I had never really challenged myself. I majored in English. They gave me a college degree for reading books, which is what I do for pleasure.
Okay.
So I felt like I had cheated in that sense, right? Like picking the easy way to get a degree.
Sounds pretty tame.
yeah. And then I felt an obligation to give something back to my larger community. My mom, as a single mom, as an artist, we had some financial challenges when I was a kid, and we spent a little bit of time on food stamps, and so I did feel this obligation to give back to the country that had given me so much when I was young and helped set me up for success. And I wanted a challenge to do something I didn't know if I could succeed at, to get out of the rut that I had dug for myself. And I lost my job. I got a new boss that we didn't click very well.
Okay.
And I cried at work a few times, which does not set you up for career success, let me tell you.
Okay.
And so we decided that it would be in our best interest for me to get a new job. I got fired. And I was trying to figure out what to do next. And wanted money for grad school, didn't know what to do. You know, had all these other thoughts going on in my head about the rut and wanting a challenge. And so stumbled on the military as an option and enlisted in the Army.
You know, going from the way that you grew up and being an English major, that's quite a stumble from studying English to going into the military.
Yeah, my parents were definitely surprised. I think a lot of my friends were surprised. I grew up a really anti-authoritarian streak. I listened to a lot of punk rock music, purple hair, combat boots, all of that. So when I ended up in the Army, like, everybody was totally shocked.
I can understand that.
They did not see it coming. But I really, my personality type actually thrived in the military setting. One of the reasons that I had some trouble at the job that I had right before I joined the Army is that I have a very direct communication style,
okay. And
I'm very task-oriented, very mission-focused, and I was working in the nonprofit world, which is a lot more touchy-feely,
mm-hmm.
a lot more people-centered, and so, and I was very young. I graduated from college when I was 20, so I had a job where I had a lot of responsibilities.
Okay.
When I was really quite young, in my early 20s, and I hadn't developed some of the nuance
okay.
in terms of interpersonal skills.
Okay.
And it didn't. But the military, for somebody who's really mission focused and doesn't necessarily spend a lot of time worrying about getting along with people in a touchy feely way.
Okay.
The military was a great fit for me, and I actually thrived in that setting, which shocked everyone, perhaps even myself.
I was about to say, what were your early experiences in the military?
So one of the reasons, you know, I told you I had this clash with my boss, and she would yell at me at the office, and I would cry. And so another little secret back of my mind reason for joining the military is I thought, you know, I bet you if I go to basic training,
mm-hmm.
I will learn to not cry when people scream in my face.
Hmm.
And that worked.
Okay.
I went to basic training,
okay.
and drill sergeants yell quite a bit. And I did learn to keep it under control, and that if I was going to cry in the bathroom, to
okay.
hold it together until I was in a private setting where I could be more emotional, but that in the thick of things, to maintain the emotional control that I needed to have in the given situation. Basic training was no fun for me. It's no fun for anyone.
Right.
But it wasn't as awful as I kind of maybe had been led to believe by the movies.
Interesting.
It was okay. It was tolerable. I made it through, and then went on to continue my training. Language training was in beautiful Monterey, California.
Wow.
Just a gorgeous
yes.
setting.
Yeah.
I could hear sea lions barking from my barracks room at night, and sometimes we'd go running on the beach for our physical fitness training. And the language training itself was really intense, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I think it's fun to learn languages, so that was a good experience. The language school, it was 63 weeks long.
Did you say 63? Okay. All right.
Yeah, over a year there. And then I did my advanced individual training at San Angelo Air Force Base in, San Angelo, Texas at Goodfellow Air Force Base.
Okay.
And so while I was at DLI out in Monterey, California, learning Arabic, that's when 9/11 happened.
Okay.
And sitting in that Arabic classroom, We didn't have access to CNN in there. They only had, like, TVs that were hooked up to foreign language channels for
okay.
language instruction use.
All right.
And so we watched the footage of 9/11 on Arabic news.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just looped the CNN feed, but it was Arabic journalists who were talking over it. That's how we watched the coverage, which was really surreal.
That's,
and my whole
yeah.
class knew right away we were going to war.
Mm-hmm.
It was no longer a question whether or not we would ever go to war. Every one of us in that room learning Arabic knew right away we were all going to go to war.
What a moment for that, for you experiencing just that moment of, here I am, I'm safe, I'm doing what I need to do, but shortly I'm not going to be here and I may not be safe anymore.
Yeah, and I was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault, out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which is a very deployable unit. And that just confirmed that I was definitely going to war.
Now, when
and
you say
part of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003.
When you say a very deployable unit, what does that mean?
So there some units in are strategic units. So especially for somebody with a job like mine, you, as an Arabic linguist or a linguist of any type in the United States military, you either get assigned to a strategic unit or a tactical unit.
Okay.
In a strategic unit, you stay somewhere, most of them are stateside, so I could have gone to, as an Arabic linguist, I could have been in, I think, Georgia. Chinese linguists can go to Hawaii, which
okay.
I'm kind of jealous of them. But in those jobs, you sit in a room, in a building with no windows, and do your job from the United States on, like, 12-hour shifts.
Okay,
and
wow.
And the reverse of that is a tactical unit, like the 101st, where if you're not at war, you may spend a lot of time going to the field and, like, kind of imagine sort of camping but without a tent or
gotcha.
As nice as stuff and still in a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But you spend a lot of time training for going to war
okay.
and not necessarily doing the job you were trained to do,
okay.
But just training for how to do that in a combat zone. And then during a wartime situation, then tactical units deploy downrange.
Okay. And I know that you are also described as a former intelligence specialist. What does that mean? How did that play out as you went to Iraq, or were you an intelligence specialist at that time?
Yeah, it's kind of a tough thing to explain to civilians how it all works. So my rank was, when we first deployed, was specialist. That's a rank in the military. And I was in a military intelligence unit. My specific training was in signals intelligence. So I was taught the Arabic language. And then with that, with the language training, you can go kind of one of two main routes. One is human intelligence, where you would go out and try to talk to people and maybe recruit sources or okay. do interrogations of detainees, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And then the other side is what I was trained to do, which is signals intelligence. The job is to do intercept and direction finding on enemy communications.
Okay.
So if you can kind of imagine sitting in your car, mm-hmm. pushing the seek button on your car stereo, trying to find a radio station.
Gotcha.
It's like that, but instead of looking for a regular radio station, you're looking for bad guys talking on the
okay.
radio.
Okay. When you first went to Iraq, what was that like? You met someone in Iraq.
But that was down the road.
So, that was
yeah,
down the road.
When we first went in, we were part of the initial invasion. So we invaded wearing chemical protective gear because people still believed at that early stage
right.
that there might be weapons of mass destruction, that we might be gassed. So we're wearing our chemical protective gear. We're driving. We drove from Kuwait all the way up to Baghdad, and then when we would have to stop the convoy to take breaks, refuel vehicles, things like that, we couldn't leave the road because nobody knew if there would be mines on the side of the road.
Okay.
So you're really just, you're staying in somebody else's footsteps. We're peeing on the side of the road in full view of everybody because, you know, I'd really prefer for somebody to catch a glimpse of my butt than to get blown up. So
gotcha.
Very intense, long drive, mm-hmm. lots of driving. But when we did stop, we also met, occasionally we'd meet Iraqi people in the south. It was Bedouins, and then once we got to Baghdad, it was a little bit different. But I, as an Arabic linguist, as somebody who spoke Arabic, got a chance to talk to the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm.
And we've lost sight of it now, with you know how awful things got later. But those very early days, the Iraqi people who were willing to come up to me mm-hmm. as an American soldier and talk to me, they all wanted to tell me how badly they suffered under the Ba'ath regime,
huh.
how much Saddam Hussein had destroyed lives and made them suffer. And that made me think that even though I had not agreed with the reasons we were given for going to war,
mm-hmm.
that maybe we were doing the right thing, that maybe we were going to make these people's lives better. We got to Baghdad, and even though I had been trained in signals intelligence, because there weren't enough Arabic interpreters, I ended up going out on combat foot patrols with the infantry in Baghdad and mm-hmm. translating between infantry soldiers and the local people. Now, this was the era of you go to war with the army you have. You may remember that quote.
I do.
So since I was a woman soldier and women weren't supposed to be in combat,
mm-hmm.
I didn't even get issued plates for my flak vest. So when I'm out there with the infantry on the combat foot patrols, I didn't even have plates in my
Well,
flak
you know,
vest.
I was going to ask you, how did the Iraqi people think about to approach you as a woman in the military? And then how did your colleagues approach you as a woman in the military?
The Iraqi people, I think, found me more approachable as a woman.
Okay.
Like the man who became my husband, he's 6'6".
Okay.
And put him in all his gear, he looks pretty scary.
Okay.
Me, I'm 5'5".
Okay.
I think I'm easier to approach.
Right.
Because I look less physically intimidating. And also for Muslim women in a Muslim country, there are some social mores, some prohibitions on talking to
yes.
unknown men.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so for them, it was much easier for them to come up and talk to me as a woman soldier. And the other side of that is both my comrades and the Iraqi people, the only thing they actually cared about was that I spoke Arabic. Like,
okay.
That trumped
everything. Okay.
Caleb,
we're going to take a break. But when we come back, I do want to talk to you more about your experience as being a woman with your colleagues. I don't
Absolutely.
Know how many women were in your unit, but you weren't the majority. Let's say that. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk and my conversation with Kayla Williams, author of Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. And we're back. This is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk as I continue my conversation with former Sergeant Kayla Williams. Kayla, you're in Iraq. You are a woman. What was that like with your colleagues?
It changed through time because we spent about a year in the Middle East. So during major combat operations, during the initial invasion, the only thing that mattered was that I spoke Arabic.
Okay.
We're all wearing that chemical protecting gear for the first month, and then
right.
You know, we're all wearing our flak vests, and we're all focused on doing the job, getting the mission done. And in that setting, the only thing that mattered was whether or not I could help accomplish the mission. And the fact that I spoke Arabic was what mattered to the infantry guys that I was around especially. But then we pushed farther north from Baghdad, pushed out to Mosul and beyond, and I ended up on the side of a mountain, Sinjar Mountain in northern Iraq near the border with Syria, first at a site with about 7 or 8 guys, and then they moved us to the other side of the mountain, and there were maybe 20 or 30 guys, and I was the only woman there.
Mm.
And while we're out there, our schedules normalized. We weren't in major combat operations. We were in a more secure site. We were around an oppressed minority, actually, that loved us and wanted us to stay.
Okay.
And weren't trying to kill us on a daily basis, so, which was quite nice, let me
yeah.
tell you. But in that setting, so we had no electricity, no TV, no video games, no
indoor plumbing.
To take a break, no indoor plumbing.
Mm.
And in that setting, that people were bored a lot, and that we had a lot more downtime. And in that setting, some more tensions could arise, and the gender issue and the division between the sexes became a little more apparent because we just had a lot more time to sit around and a lot less time focused on getting an important, you know, job, life or death job done.
Mm-hmm.
And people, as the deployment dragged on, people also started to get kind of worn down by the stress of being away from home for so long, of
okay.
never getting a real break. Because, yes, we had breaks when we weren't actively on shift. We weren't
mm-hmm.
actively doing our jobs, but we never got a real break. You don't
right.
get nights off. You don't get weekends off.
Right.
You can't go out to the bar and, you know, have a few beers and blow off steam. You can't
mm-hmm.
go home to your spouse and,
mm-hmm.
or boyfriend or girlfriend. And so the tension of being deployed for a whole year started to wear on people. I'd say between months 6 and 8, that was the toughest time when people were really just worn down by the strain of the deployment. Once we hit like the 9th month, you could see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay.
Like, okay, we're almost done. We're about to go home. And things kind of normalized. But the 6th through the 8th month, those were the really bad ones. And I saw people kind of breaking down. And you saw a breakdown of discipline. And during that overall breakdown of discipline where I saw a guy refuse to shave for a few weeks, this is a really big deal in the Army. They're really big on guys shaving.
Yeah.
Another guy who cried and punched himself in the face all night because he was just freaking out.
Mm.
In that situation, that's when I also experienced some sexual harassment, and it was part of this larger breakdown of discipline that breakdown of that discipline also occurred, and I had some negative experiences on that side as well.
Okay, do you want to talk about those experiences or no?
It's fine with me. I mean, it happened a long time ago, but I'd say the worst experience was one night I went to talk to a friend when I got off of a shift pulling guard duty, and the friend that I expected to be there wasn't there. It was a different guy who hadn't woken my friend up for his shift.
Oh.
And this guy, I was really surprised. He asked if I might want to sleep with him, and he didn't just ask, though. I realized it was dark, and I was really startled when I realized this, figured it out. But he had actually pulled out his penis, and he grabbed my hand and tried to put my hand on his penis. And I was shocked and appalled and
mm-hmm.
angry and said, I'm not interested. No, I don't want to do that. And his backup was, well, you know, if you don't want to have sex, what about, like, would you just give me a blowjob? I'm like, really? This is your plan B?
Wow. Well,
like,
yeah.
You think, like, I won't go for the, you know, go all in, so maybe this back. And I said, no, I'm not interested. What about your girlfriend? Aren't you engaged? He's like, oh, she doesn't have to know this and that. And
mm-hmm.
I said, no, I was really angry. Felt really betrayed, really shocked. I did not feel like I was in danger. I had my rifle.
Okay.
And I knew there were other people nearby enough that if he had persisted and I yelled, you know, I felt confident that somebody would have stepped up. But I felt betrayed and angry.
Mm.
And the next day he came and apologized, And that made me angry too, because it kind of, I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, if he hadn't acknowledged that he did something wrong, mm-hmm. I would have felt like that it was easier to file a formal complaint.
I see.
But since he acknowledged that he had mm-hmm. made a mistake, he acknowledged he had screwed up,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, well,
now what do you do?
Do I still complain? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I'm seeing these guys breaking down in other ways. Was this a single bad act by somebody who's just under intense stress and
mm-hmm.
pressure, and I should accept his apology and move on? Or is it part of a larger pattern of behavior that he's exhibited with other women? Is it something that I'm obligated to report because he's a genuinely bad guy? And
mm-hmm.
I really struggled with it. So ultimately what I decided to do was that rather than filing a formal complaint, I informally told his leadership what had happened, and they moved him to a different location. But it just still rankled me for months to come, and
sure.
wondering if I'd made the right call. So when we got back to the United States, I went to his unit's equal opportunity representative and wrote what's called a memorandum for record.
Okay.
So a formal memo detailing what had happened, and had them put it in his file so that if he never did anything bad again, it wouldn't ruin his career.
Okay.
If he just had one breakdown, it wouldn't ruin his career. But that if any other women ever came forward, it would show that there was a pattern of behavior and they'd be able to throw the book at him. And to this day, years later, I don't know that it was the perfect decision. I don't know that it was the right way to approach it. Maybe I
mm-hmm.
should have filed a formal complaint at the beginning. But, you know, at the time, that was the compromise that I made that I felt like was the most reasonable approach for me at that time.
Did you?
And I'll never know if it was the right call. I mean,
sure.
have no way of knowing if he, you know, if it is a pattern for him. But that was a choice I made at the time.
Did you share the experience with any of the members of your team?
I talked to other people. I don't know that I told my teammates because I didn't feel at that point we had a couple of new people on the team. I didn't feel
mm-hmm.
really close to them yet.
Okay.
But I was close to some of the other people in the guys unit, and most of them said, and this is one of the things that was frustrating for me about the military at that time, the message that I got from a lot of my peers, and again, I did not report this to my unit leadership, but the message I got from the people I considered my peers, people of similar rank to me,
mm-hmm.
guys
mm-hmm.
of a similar rank to me, was, how are you going to ruin his career just
uh-huh.
because you can't take it? What did you expect when you joined a man's army?
Mm-hmm.
And that message of pressure from my peer group not to report, and this sense that he, as a man, as a male soldier, his career was more important than mine.
Right.
That was really upsetting. And it definitely changed the way I presented myself and the way that I felt. I stopped being as friendly. I stopped being as outgoing.
Mm.
I started to feel as if in that setting, though not necessarily in garrison, but in Iraq, in a deployed situation, if I were too friendly and too outgoing in this high-stress deployment situation away from home, away from families, that there was too much of a risk that men would interpret my friendliness as an invitation to being more than just friends,
mm-hmm.
and that I had to present myself as really kind of tough and really professional all the time, and I couldn't just joke around and relax and fully be, you know, just be comfortable and myself. I felt like I had to put on a front of being hyper-professional all the time. And that got exhausting.
It sounds like you were fighting two wars.
Yeah, and I kind of did. I mean, not necessarily two wars, but yeah, I lost the sense of unit cohesion that
uh-huh.
can be important, the sense of being able to fully trust my comrades. I don't know if I can use bad words on your show, but...
No, you can't.
Joke. Oh, okay. Then I won't.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's fast forward. I can only imagine the joke, but let's fast forward to when you met the person who is now your husband.
Yeah. So as I said, when I was telling people about the sexual harassment, most people said, you know, don't report. There was one guy that I had met out there on the side of the mountain who was smart and charismatic, really funny, sarcastic, witty, dry sense of humor, handsome, tall. And I thought he was really interesting. And of all the guys out there, He's the only one who said, you should report it. You should tell somebody. Mm. You should not keep this a secret. Mm. He's the one who encouraged me to step up and report what had happened to at least the unit leadership. So that guy, Brian McGuff, he, I thought, was just such an interesting guy. And one day, I mean, it wasn't a romantic environment. We couldn't go out on a date. We couldn't go out clubbing, anything like that. But I confessed to him one night, I really want to get to know you better. And he said, don't worry, there's plenty of time for that when we get home.
Mm.
And then a few months later, he was severely wounded when an improvised explosive device went off and hit the bus that he was traveling on, coming back from mid-tour leave. Shrapnel entered the back of his head on the right side under his Kevlar and traveled forward and exited near his right eye.
Mm.
And he nearly died. He was medically evacuated to Baghdad, where he had emergency neurosurgery. And
let me interrupt you, yes, for a second, because he was medevaced to get some medical assistance, but there was a challenge there because they weren't going to do that initially.
Yeah. In a triage situation, where a mass casualty situation where there are multiple injuries, the first responders have to make a decision on who to evacuate and who doesn't need to be evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the training is done on that is, if you're the walking wounded, if you're walking and talking, you're not as high a priority as somebody who's not walking or talking. And shockingly, Brian was walking and talking.
That is amazing.
Lucid.
Yeah.
And so they thought he wasn't a priority. But luckily, one of his friends who was there was really persistent and insisted that they had to get him on a helicopter and get him out, because some of the shrapnel had actually stayed lodged in his skull, and so there was a piece of shrapnel sticking out of the back of his head. And so his friend said, you have to get him on the helicopter. And eventually the crew agreed. They got him on a helicopter, and it was lucky that they did, because what nobody knew at the time was that either a piece of the shrapnel or a piece of bone that got dislodged had severed an artery inside his skull. And so he was bleeding out inside his skull into the brain.
Oh my.
By the time he got off the helicopter in Baghdad, he was starting to crash, was losing lucidity, was becoming incoherent, and would have died soon thereafter if they hadn't gotten him into neurosurgery immediately.
And saved his life.
Saved his life.
But
absolutely. He would have died in any previous conflict, I'm completely sure.
Kayla, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to move a bit to he lived, his life was saved, and that was phenomenal. But things really started to deteriorate even further after that. So when we come back, I'd like for you to talk to us about that.
Absolutely.
This is Pamela Brewer, folks, and you're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Kayla Williams, who is the author of Plenty of Time When We Get Home. We'll take a break and we'll be right back. And we are back. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation with Kayla Williams, a former sergeant in the U.S. Army. Kayla, Brian's life was saved. What happened then?
So he was stable. He had neurosurgery in Baghdad, and the neurosurgeon who I tracked down when I was doing the research for this book believed that Brian might be confined to a wheelchair if he walked, that he would have a walker, and thought that he might never be functionally independent, that he might never recover well enough to get a job, live on his own. But he was stabilized, put on a plane to Germany,
and sent to a hospital,
wasn't
he? Woke
up in the hospital in Germany.
Okay.
A nurse was talking to him, and Brian couldn't understand him. And Brian didn't know what had happened. He didn't know about the shrapnel. He didn't know what had gone on. He thought he had just hit his head really hard.
Okay, how old was he then?
A nurse talking to him, and he couldn't understand the nurse. And Brian thought, "Oh my God, I've lost the ability to understand language."
Huh.
Then they further sedated him. The next day, when he came to, there was a doctor there from Landstuhl Medical Center, which is the Army hospital, the U.S. Army hospital in Germany, who said, "We were not equipped to handle a neurological case as severe as yours, so you are at a German hospital." So he hadn't understood the nurse because the nurse had been speaking German.
Now, Kayla, how old was Brian at that point?
Oh, I should have that memorized, shouldn't I? It was 10 years ago, and it's probably 28, his late 20s.
Okay. I mean, just.
And so he was further stabilized and transferred to the U.S. Army hospital in Landstuhl, Germany, and after he was further stabilized there, was evacuated back to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in the United States and stayed there as an inpatient for a couple more months.
Now, wasn't there a period of time when his parents were trying to locate him and he was kind of lost in the system?
Yes. Because Landstuhl sent him to that German hospital, he wasn't at Landstuhl, and whoever was answering the phones at the switchboard didn't know what had happened. And so, yes, his parents had been notified that their son had been injured and was being evacuated to Germany. And then when they're trying to find out what had happened, nobody knew where he was. So, yeah, it was just, I can't imagine, now that I have kids of my own, I can't imagine what it was like for his poor mother to be in that situation.
It sounds horrific. Talk to us. He's now, take us to Walter Reed. He's there. He's got a diagnosis. He knows what's going on with him. And he's getting treatment and all of that stuff, right?
So as an inpatient, things were okay. He got some early rehab as an inpatient. Some early therapy, was going to appointments. But, you know, the military, the Army, I think, did not really know what to do with somebody with his type of brain injury, because he was walking and talking again and doing reasonably well. He was not so severely injured that he was confined to a bed or confined to a wheelchair. He was able to communicate, and what they told him after a few months was, "Well, you can walk and talk and wipe your own butt, so it's time for you to go back to your unit." So after he was done with the inpatient phase of his treatment, they released him and sent him back to Fort Campbell, our permanent duty station. We later learned that was a mistake. But in those early days, I think they just didn't know what to do. They probably needed the bed. They needed the room at Walter Reed. And so they sent him back to Fort Campbell. He should have gone to what's known as a medical holding company.
Okay.
But for whatever reason, he didn't, and was sent straight back to his artillery battery.
Oh,
they
my.
Had no idea what to do with him.
Oh,
I mean,
my.
Here's this guy whose injury was still fresh enough that he couldn't wear headgear, because the scars on his head were recent enough. He couldn't wear a hat, and the Army's really big on people wearing their hats.
Yeah.
He still had to get his head shaved at the hospital by people specially trained on how to shave around fresh incisions. He had was already developing what came to be a very severe case of post-traumatic stress disorder, so he couldn't carry a weapon. And what his unit leadership told him was, "Well, you know, you can't do your job, you can't carry a weapon, you look really messed up, and you're freaking out the new guys who just show up out of basic training and get assigned here. You're scaring them, knowing that they're going to have to go to war when we go back to war later this year. So why don't you just stay home?" So,
well, that's a treatment plan for you. That's a great treatment plan.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was awful. And it's not the Army that I thought I knew, right? Because the Army that I thought I knew, they make everybody show up for what's called accountability formation in the morning, and maybe again in the afternoon, or they make everyone stand in neat little lines and make sure that everybody is where they're supposed to be. But he wasn't even being asked to go in for accountability formation anymore. It was like, at the time, I was just caught up in the middle of it and didn't know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, I can see how every bad thing compounded every other bad thing. So he's getting PTSD and he can't sleep because of the PTSD and the nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And not sleeping made his cognitive function decline,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I think all of us, you
right.
know, you go without sleep for a night and you can't think as clearly.
Exactly.
So as his cognitive function is suffering, and he's thinking, I'm never going to be able to hold down a job. I don't know who I am anymore. I'm losing my career in the military, and I don't know if I can ever work. I can't even think straight. And that's making him more depressed. And being depressed and the PTSD, and he's not getting proper mental health care.
Right.
So he's turning to alcohol to self-medicate to
Great.
Try to numb the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And the alcohol, bad for brain injuries,
Right.
bad for PTSD, bad
Right.
for depression.
Right.
That combined with the fact that he had suffered damage to the executive control function of his brain, he's going into these rages, he's starting fights in bars, he's no impulse control, spending all his money as soon as he gets paid, and just spiraling down into a bad, bad situation.
What was the significance of the term code black in your relationship? What did that mean?
So when he would go into one of these rages, it was scary. He
mm-hmm.
could be violent. He could be vicious and cruel and hurtful.
Towards you?
And so he would push me out. He would push me away emotionally and tell me to get out. And so if he could feel it coming on, if he thought it was coming, that he was going to go into one of these rages, he would tell me code black and just want to be left alone for a few days until he came out of it, rather than hurt me emotionally while he was in the middle of it. But, you know, he didn't always know it was coming on, and sometimes I would get kind of caught in the crossfire of his emotional, like, catastrophic emotional state.
And when you say caught in the crossfire, what does that mean?
He could be vicious and cruel verbally, and there were a couple of times when he did get physically violent with me.
And you stayed?
I stayed.
Talk about
yeah.
that. Talk about that.
I'm still trying to untangle that, why I stayed. You know, part of it was this military ethos of not leaving a fallen comrade,
okay.
not leaving a wounded comrade on the battlefield. And even though we'd come home from the actual battlefield, I could see that this was not the Brian that I had met before he
mm-hmm.
was injured. And I thought, you know, if he had lost a leg, I wouldn't say like, oh, well, like, it's really annoying
mm-hmm.
that you've lost a leg, so I'm just going to leave you and go date somebody who's whole.
Mm-hmm.
And so leaving somebody who was suffering from a psychological and cognitive injury would be just as awful as leaving somebody suffering from any other type of injury.
Okay.
And there was also, I mean, we had fallen in love, and
mm-hmm.
love isn't terribly logical. So that's
usually
part of it.
Not.
But I also just clung to this conviction that just as a broken leg will heal, that his injured mind would heal,
mm.
and that if we just tried hard enough, that he would get better. And I ended up being right. It just took maybe three times as long as I thought
mm-hmm.
it would. And it was a really, really rough road to get better. But he did heal. He did come back. And I'm glad now that I stuck with him. But there were definitely times when I didn't know why I was staying and wondered if I was making the right decision, because it was a very challenging road to recovery.
And you talk about that certainly in compelling detail in your book. There was a time, I mean, you were struggling as well. It's not like you were just there and you were all together and just trying to be warm and loving towards him. You were having your own struggles. And I am embarrassed to actually read about the way some of the mental health folks treated, or more accurately, didn't treat you.
Yeah, this was early in the war. that Brian was injured. He was injured in October of 2003. I came home in February of 2004. And I think there's a lot that people didn't know yet about mm-hmm. what women were experiencing in today's conflicts. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a perception that since I was a woman, I wouldn't have experienced combat.
Yes.
And so when I was showing what are, you know, reasonably typical symptoms of post-traumatic stress, I think the providers I saw didn't connect that to my combat deployment. And also, maybe they had no training or experience in how to support caregivers. And so while I was dealing with my own reintegration, my own symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and trying to be a caregiver when I didn't know how to be a caregiver and didn't know anything about PTSD or TBI, so I didn't know how to support my husband. Well, he wasn't my husband yet.
TBI, traumatic brain injury.
Thank you. Traumatic brain injury, TBI. So I didn't know what he was going through, and I was just under tremendous amount of stress. When I did reach out and ask for help. And the first provider that I saw, who was a psychologist, one of my ways of reacting to stress is to become hyper-controlling mm-hmm. and to really try to control my environment. Like mm-hmm. so many things are outside my control.
Right.
So anything I could control, I would just go overboard on that.
Okay.
You know, all my canned goods lined up, mm-hmm. labels facing front, towels trifolded, mm-hmm. bottoms, edges exactly. Mm-hmm. Like my dad also is this way. And so I don't know if you remember the movie Sleeping with the Enemy.
Yes.
And her husband is that way. Mm-hmm. And my dad and I are like, what? What's
what's wrong with everybody else, right?
Trifold towels. Are you kidding? So, yeah. So I have a natural tendency to be that way. And the military rewards that. They really reward people who are hyper-organized and extremely detail-oriented and very precise. And so I'm talking to this civilian psychologist. She's like, I think you have obsessive compulsive disorder, and I think you might have bipolar disorder, and so you need to go to a psychiatrist. So I went to the division psychiatrist. So this is the one psychiatrist assigned for 18,000 soldiers.
That's extraordinary.
My husband was seeing him, we weren't married yet, but Brian was seeing him and did fine with him. But for whatever reason, this guy, he and I did not click. When I first walked in and I was trying to tell him what I was going through and that I was scared that I wasn't going to be able to make it as a civilian because, I just didn't feel connected to civilian society anymore. And I was having these symptoms that seemed weird to civilians but normal to other soldiers. Mm-hmm. And I started crying in his office, and he laughed at me and said, like, yeah, you'll never make it as a civilian if you cry all the time. And he sent me away with a pack of meds, and that was that. And the meds made me feel thirsty all the time and kind of just off and jittery. And mm-hmm. so I quit taking them after the starter pack and didn't go back seeking mental health care for a long, long time.
I can understand.
I wish that I had persisted earlier.
Yeah. The way that you were treated is fairly horrifying. Kayla, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to continue with more of what you were going through. And well, let me just leave it there. We'll continue in just a moment. Folks, you're listening to Kayla Williams, former sergeant in the military and the author of Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. We'll return. And we're back. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation with Kayla Williams. Kayla, there was a point in your book where you say that because you were military intelligence, you had no expectation of privacy when you talked to your doctor. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, because I had a security clearance and access to highly classified information, there isn't the same expectation of privacy. If the provider that I talked to thought that there was a risk to national security based on my mental health state, they would be able to talk to my commander about what was going on. And there have been some efforts also to change things to make it easier for people in the intelligence community to seek help. So there's a form you have to fill out to get a security clearance, and on it there's a question about whether or not you are getting mental health treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's been changed now to so that you do not have to disclose mental health care related to combat trauma. And that change was made specifically to help people like me feel more comfortable going and getting help,
okay,
knowing that you can talk about your combat trauma and that it's not going to harm your career.
Okay. You were going through many things on your own. You were dealing with Brian. There came a point at which taking your own life seemed to be a reasonable response.
Yes, I experienced what I came to know is called suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm.
I felt so trapped. I mean, I'd always had this feeling like, you know, if I know something's going to end, I can push through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can spend a year in Iraq. I can do anything that's going to end. But I had this feeling like, what if my situation never ends? Like, I felt trapped with Brian. I had this fear that if I left him, he would die. And I felt trapped by that responsibility, overwhelmed by that responsibility,
mm-hmm.
Afraid that I would never feel better, afraid that I would never be able to just go shopping at Walmart and feel normal ever again, that I would, that I wouldn't finish the reintegration process, the readjustment process,
mm-hmm.
and that I would never feel normal again. And I started to think the only way out would be if I died. And so I did think about it. I sat down and, you know, there was one night I sat and held a gun in my hand and looked at it and wondered if that was the only way that I would be able to get out. And I didn't take my own life. I did push through. But, yeah, there were some feelings of really profound hopelessness.
Now, was that the same time when Brian was having one of his moments and you ran into the bedroom and pulled the gun out from under the pillow that he slept with ever since he got back? Was that the same time?
No, that was my roommate who slept with a gun
under
his pillow. There was one incident where I thought about taking my own life.
Okay.
And I couldn't do it. I couldn't bring myself mm-hmm. to do it. And then Brian and I stayed together and we got married. We got him transferred back to Walter Reed so that he could get better care because he was just falling apart at Fort Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
We got married. I moved there to join him and things were not getting better. They seemed like they were kind of okay for a while, but then mm-hmm. they started to get bad again and get even worse. And I reached a point where, again, I hit that breaking point and thought, I can't do it, and the only escape from this situation would be death. But I knew that I just, for whatever reason, I didn't have it in me to kill myself, but I mm-hmm. thought that maybe with Brian's PTSD, maybe he can do it.
Hmm.
And so I went, he owned a gun, and I took it, and I said, kill me. Just, you do it. You know, you're this full of rage,
mm-hmm.
and you're this, you know, it felt like he hated me when he would be in those code black moments.
I'm sure.
You hate me this much and you're this full of rage, then you do it. You kill me. And he actually put the gun to my head and pulled the trigger, but it wasn't loaded.
Mm.
And then he called me crazy and called me a lot of other names that I guess I can't say on your show.
Probably not.
And then I left. I left and I called the police and said, I'm afraid he might hurt himself because, I mean, it was a very bad, bad night. And I went to the hotel. I cried myself to sleep. And the next morning, I thought, okay, I can either lay in this bed, hotel bed, and feel sorry for myself all day, or I can get out. I already have plans to go rock climbing with a friend of mine from the Army. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go see her. I cannot lay in this bed and just feel sorry for myself all day. And while we were at the rock climbing gym, I fell rock climbing and broke my ankle.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, and I had to call Brian to meet me at the hospital because he had my insurance card, my ID card to get medical care. He didn't remember the night before. He just knew he was really hungover and that the house was a disaster. And I had to get a cast and keep my cast elevated above my heart for 6 weeks and take care of myself. And in a bizarre way, that saved our marriage. Hmm. It reversed our roles. So here's this man who had been a leader of men in the Army, and all of that had been stripped away from him, his identity taken from him, and he was put in a situation where I took care of him, and he had to rely on me. And then when I became helpless and he had to take care of me, it kind of kicked back into gear that part of his brain that could be the strong one. And it didn't give him the opportunity to sit around and do nothing and let me take care of him. He had to take care of me. And it forced me to, instead of just being in like hyper mission mode, like I will control everything, I had to empathize with how he felt being helpless because I was helpless all of a sudden. And instead of just doing, I had to think and feel. And it reset our relationship, and that was rock bottom. That night was rock bottom for us, and it allowed us to, when we finally hit it, to start to come out of the other side of the pit of despair that we had gone into. And that was the beginning of his recovery and our road as a family from the war trauma to healing.
Kaylee, unfortunately, I could actually talk to you for at least another hour, but the time is not being kind to my needs to talk to you. But I want to ask you, why write this book? There's so much pain in it. There's so much horror in it, and clearly love. But
thank you. Yes, the first half details the pain and the horror, but the second half details the hope, healing, recovery, and love.
Absolutely.
I want to communicate to anyone who has experienced trauma. Ours was war trauma, but people experience all kinds of different trauma, from childhood abuse to natural disasters.
Right.
I want everyone who experiences trauma to know that there is a road to recovery,
okay,
that there is a path to healing, and that, yes, post-traumatic stress disorder is very real, but there can also be post-traumatic growth, that going through that trauma can open a space for developing more empathy for your fellow man, greater spiritual connection. It can open a space to grow and experience a new normal where you are still a contributing member of society, where you can serve your community in new ways. I want to encourage people to seek help if they can't do it alone, and that just as if you tried toothpaste and you didn't like the flavor of a particular kind, you wouldn't swear off brushing your teeth forever. And similarly, if you go to a therapist and you don't click, don't give up on mental health care forever. Try a new therapist.
Absolutely.
And to just keep trying, try and not give up, find ways to heal, whether it's, for some people it's getting involved in sports. For others, it's getting involved in community service. There's a great organization called Team Rubicon where military veterans respond to natural disasters like Hurricane Sandy and use their military skills to serve their communities in new ways. There's an organization called The Mission Continues where military veterans get fellowships to serve their communities in new ways. Blue Star Families is an organization that serves military families. And I want any veteran in crisis who's listening to your show to know that they can call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1 for 24-hour assistance. Nobody should suffer alone. There is a path towards healing and recovery. And anybody who has experienced a difficult time should accept help if they need it, reach out and ask for it, because there can be a new normal, and it can be a fulfilling and rewarding and enjoyable life again.
Kayla, can you just give us that number again?
Absolutely. It's 1-800-273-TALK, and veterans can press 1.
All right. Kayla, thank you so much for your time, for your book, for sharing your story. And the next book you write, and I know there'll be a next one, please let me know, because I would love to have you back talking more about what your experiences have been and hearing more about your growth and your power.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All righty. You take care. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you have been listening to Mind Talk. Think about what you have heard today. Think about the impact of post-traumatic stress and the war, and think about reaching out for help when help is what you need. It's your right. You deserve it. Thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. This program is not intended to take the place of professional care, including medical and mental health services. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And for more information about Mind Talk, go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable.